When we think about human beings, we're all capable of making mistakes, errors. There's some things that we mess up, and that's what we want to talk about tonight. When I, not when others, but when I admit my faults and try to overcome them. When we think about the word fault, he gives us a definition for it, but what definitions might we use? Fault, in the sense of we've messed up.
Blame.
All right, blame is going to be one of the things. I mean, if we're at fault, then we should be the person that's blamed. What else? Fault. You said weakness?
Yes.
All right, sometimes we make a mistake or sin. Spiritually, we do that because we're weak. This is going to be something that's discussed in this topic. What else? Fault.
Imperfection.
All right, there's going to be some kind of imperfection. We've maybe tried to do something or we failed to do something and the work is imperfect. That's a good definition. Anything else? Fault.
Blunder.
All right, I like that word. We've made a blunder. We don't use that word too often, but that's another excellent word. Anything else? A fault. All right, stumble. Scripture certainly uses that term. Anything else? Fault. Falling short, missing the mark, a lot of different ideas. His definitions include a weakness, a failing, a mistake, a shortcoming, and as we noted earlier, even a sin. As used in the Bible, it often describes a sin. It includes all people. Romans 3:23, Paul said, "For all have sinned and they fall short of glory, God's glory." That word that is used there described missing the mark. It was, for example, an arrow that was directed towards a target, and the arrow is off target. It misses the mark, if you will. If you've ever shot some kind of gun, or if you've ever aimed at something, maybe you were throwing a baseball, you're in a baseball game, and you're throwing towards the batter, and you missed the mark. You hit the batter, or maybe you had a ball that was outside the mark. So the Bible uses that same kind of analogy. He says, too, in the second paragraph, some can quickly, easily detect their own faults, while others may be slow to recognize them. Why is that? Some seem to be just good at looking at themselves and finding their mistakes and their others, and then other people, I mean, you know, after 50 years, they just don't get it.
I think it's a whole lot easier to see what somebody else is doing wrong, and I don't apply that to myself.
Yes. Doesn't feel nearly as fun to apply that standard to yourself and say, well, these are my shortcomings, but it's really easy to go ahead. And Jesus recognized in that in Matthew 7, where he talked about trying to find the little sliver in the brother's eye, and you just can't see all the mess of bad stuff in your own eye. So there is that human tendency. That's exactly right. Why else?
Our conscience, I know it's not a safe guide if you don't have biblical teaching, but if we know what's right and wrong.
Okay. If we've tried to properly train our mind, then hopefully that's going to be engaged and we're going to be looking at our lives, examining our lives, looking for the shortcomings that we have. Somebody else, well, hey, you know, my standard is the other people in life and I'm at least as good as they are, maybe a whole lot better, so I'm great. There's no problem. So conscience has a big part in this as well. Anything else? Let's ask the question once more. He says, some people can readily, quickly, easily detect their own faults. Others may be slow to recognize them, or they just never pay any attention at all. Why is that, Dolores?
Some people have too much pride.
Okay.
And I was humility.
Yes, that was one of the answers I was hoping that somebody would touch on. They just feel like they are so far above everybody else that whatever imperfections or wherever they lack, they're just heads and tails above everybody else, so no big deal. So pride is another reason for that. Why else?
Why can some detect that in themselves easier than others?
Well, if pride is one of the problems that prevents you from seeing it, then what's the opposite of pride?
Humble.
Humility. So if you have a humble person, do you think that that person is likely going to be more inclined to see the shortcomings?
Sure.
Absolutely. Because they're going to be sensitive to the things wherein they fall short. What else?
Critical of oneself.
All right, you have that too. People come in all different flavors as far as personalities. There are some people, they really don't care. They go through life and their personality is such where as long as nobody really complains or fires them or yells at them, it's good. Okay. And then you have some other people for various reasons. Maybe it's background, maybe it's personality, but they want to make sure that everything is exactly perfect. And they will adjust things and keep working at things and lose some sleep over things to make sure that it is exactly right. So there are different reasons for that. But you do find that personalities, have some impact there as well. But hopefully Christianity is going to be the thing that overrides even the personality, and people are mindful of their faults and their shortcomings, especially when they come to the spiritual realm. Anybody else before we pick up with the next idea?
Maybe a little bit of laziness.
All right, that can factor in there as well, perhaps because of background. But there are some people, they're satisfied on just getting by, whatever that means in their particular situation. They're not all that motivated, and that's their standard. So on the bad end of it, that's also something that we see. He mentions the psalmist, Psalm 19, verse 12. Let's head somebody over there, and let's get two or three other readers lined up. 1 Corinthians 1, 1 Corinthians 5, and if you take the 1 Corinthians 5, we'll also ask you to read 1 Corinthians 6. In just a minute, who wants to pick up Psalm 19, verse 12, Sherman? After that, 1 Corinthians 1, 10 to 12. 1 Corinthians 1, 10 to 12. All right, Julie. And then 1 Corinthians 5:1, and then after a pause, 1 Corinthians 6:1. Almost back to back, Betty. 1 Corinthians 5:1 and 6:1. Let's go back to the Old Testament, Psalm 19, verse 12.
Who can discern his errors? Declare me innocent from hidden faults.
Okay, let's fill in the blank. God, cleanse me. This is my prayer. Cleanse me, free me. I want to be rid of what? My secret faults. So here's a fellow who is really interested in being right with the Lord. If you had to define, in general terms, these secret sins or these secret faults, what would kind of come to mind as you start thinking about that? The secret sins, the secret faults in a person's life.
Shortcomings.
All right. Can we add anything to that? They would be shortcomings, but what kind of shortcomings would they be as far as a category? All right. There are things that are hidden, maybe hidden from others. You might find a person who is... You ever have a person, for example, come along and say, I'm a loudmouth? Anybody ever hear somebody say that? Well, now that may be a good thing in some circumstances. That may be a problem in some other areas. But there's a person, he's coming out and saying, this is my personality. What else do we hear as far as a person coming out and saying, this is what I am? And that's not always a good thing.
I'm so dumb.
All right. They may say that. What else? They acknowledge some kind of shortcoming.
Somebody say vain.
All right. You may have, could be a man, but I'm more inclined to think that a lady may say that. A lady may say, I'm so vain. I check the mirror 22 times a day to make sure that my hair is right and my makeup is right and that my teeth shine and on all those kinds of things. But they will be open about that. I don't want to be caught outside without my wig. I've got a neighbor like that. I mean, she's just come right out and said, I've got a variety of wigs, and you're never going to see me without my wig. You know, I'm vain. But okay, you know, at least you're honest on that particular point. What else do people acknowledge? It's not always positive.
Some will say that they're critical.
All right, you do have that. And in the church sometimes you find some people, I love to criticize people. Well, that's not always going to be a good thing. And maybe the majority of the time that's not always going to be a good thing. But you do have some people who will make that statement.
I don't think it's ever a good thing.
Hmm?
I don't think it's ever a good thing.
Well, there's constructive criticism.
Yeah.
But generally, as I say, when you think about being critical, yeah, it's usually headed in the wrong direction. So you will have people make that statement. What else?
Patience.
All right. You'll have people come out and say, I'm just not a patient person. And it's almost like that's a boast. So if you need additional help, if you need somebody to show some compassion, don't expect me. Again, it's honest. But that's probably not the best quality. All right, we recognize that people do those kinds of things, but what about the secret sins?
Jealousy.
All right, that's probably going to be one. There are people who are envious or people who are jealous. You can take it back to what Tracy said a moment ago. What about the vain person? Do you think there's probably some secret envy or jealousy there? Boy, I've got to spend all this time fixing my hair, or I've got to spend all this time doing this, that, and the other thing. And everything for him or her just falls into place. You know, they got out of bed and they look great in the morning, those kinds of things. So that's going to be one. What else? Secret sins.
Jesus talks about the man looking up on women with the lust.
All right, you've got Matthew 5, 25 to 30. You've got that context there. Lust is generally going to be a secret sin. Now, you may have some people come out and say, hey, I think you're hot, and let's do this, that, or the other. But I would say in the majority of cases, that's going to be something that is a secret sin. What else? Secret sin. What about hate? Now, you will have some people who will come out and say, I hate you. I wish you were dead. But I would suspect in the majority of cases, people, they may not show open hate, maybe some dislike, but that hate is probably going to be concealed to a great degree. All right, you've got a lot of secret sins that would fall into the sexual category. You've got adultery, you've got pedophiles, you've got pornography, you've got, let's see, what else didn't we? You know, same-sex attraction, that's going to be another thing that some people struggle with. So there's kind of a whole subcategory there when you look at, as you said, from Matthew chapter 5, the lust there, and that's going to encompass a number of things. So for a lot of people, they're going to try to keep those kinds of things secret. What else?
Until a person gets caught, lying can be a secret.
All right. You know, they think that everybody's going to look at me as an honest person, but what they're actually conveying more times than not is some kind of deception. You know, what about theft? Do you think there are some people who secretly steal things? You know, they don't want anybody to know. Maybe it's because of the excitement or some other things. So here is this psalmist, Psalm 19, verse 12, and he says, I want you to cleanse me from my secret faults. Now that tells me something about the person who's really trying to serve God. I read an article about this, which I thought was a pretty good piece. I didn't bring it or anything like that. But the writer talked about the fact that Christians can fall into this trap. We can get to a point where we get pretty comfortable with our Christian life. And by comfortable, I mean we can kind of go through our list and say, well, okay, this is generally how I'm living. And we can have kind of a negative form of righteousness. I don't do all the things that the people in the world typically do. And when I compare myself to brothers A, B, C, D, and E, and sisters F, G, H, I, and K, you know, I stack up pretty well. If you get to that point as a Christian, what's the temptation? Where, well, okay, you can get to the point where you're filled with pride.
You end up not being productive anymore.
Okay, I'm going to add a little bit to that. You're not growing as you should because you feel like you've almost plateaued. And, you know, maybe it's true that you are not like that non-Christian. And maybe it's true that out of a congregation of, you know, 10, 20, 50, 100, 500 people, maybe it's true that you are really one of the cream of the crop compared to the other folks. But still, what have we learned from Romans 3:23? For all have sinned, past tense, and they fall short, present tense of God's glory. So if we get to the point where we start looking, you know, hey, everything seems to be pretty good in my life, I feel very comfortable, then it's time to go a little deeper, isn't it? Then it's time to start looking for what? Those sins that may not be as obvious. And see if we can start pruning those things as well. So when we think about the Christian growth part of life, it should be a continuous thing. And that becomes a little more difficult. Think of it in terms of the old miners. You buy a mine, and you go in there and you start mining. Well, you know, I've never been a miner, but just looking at that from what I would argue is common sense, where are you probably going to start mining at in the mine if you're going for gold, silver mine? You're going to, you know, just start blasting back, you know, 3 miles? Where are you going to start mining at? You start mining at the front. I mean, you get the easy stuff first, right? That's how we generally look at life. I mean, if you're going to trim expenses on a budget, before you start going after the minute stuff, where do you begin if you got to cut stuff? Let's go after the fat, right? I mean, that's how it works. Family business. All right. In the Christian life, doesn't it work in the same way? We should try to go after those obvious sins. But once we've started to lop off those, then we're trying to kind of refine things and look for what might be referred to as the smaller items. Okay, there are a couple of hands that... Okay. Yeah, there were those secret sins in his life. I mean, again, he'd knocked off the big stuff, and that was commendable, but he thought he'd arrived, and he wasn't nearly at the plateau that he thought it was. So if you begin to kind of screen out some of those smaller things, be amazing. You might be amazed as far as some of the things that you uncover and say, hey, these are some additional items to work on. Anybody else before we move on?
You also got to look at, when Jesus talked about the gifts, everybody has a different ability, and so to compare yourself to the other foolish, because your ability may be a lot more than the person you're sitting next to. Mm-hmm. And so that's where you can get in trouble. Think, well, you can't compare yourself to one another because everybody has a different ability.
Paul actually condemned that pretty sharply when he was dealing with the Corinthians. They kind of, and that's exactly what he says, they compared themselves to themselves. They'd sort of set themselves up as their own standard and said, well, hey, you know, I look pretty good. Well, if that's your standard, then that indeed may be true. But Paul said that's not right. You know, you've got this standard that's been given by God, and everybody comes out short on that.
So it really makes it tougher.
It does.
Because you've got to really interrogate yourself to see where you are in that part of that gift that God did give you.
Yeah. Well, remember what Paul said, 2 Corinthians, I think it's 13, verse 5, try your own selves, prove your own selves, examine your own selves to see that you're in the faith. So we talk about sometimes self-examination when we deal with the Lord's Supper. You know, we're coming together, making sure that we're focused on the right things. That's perfectly good and right. But self-examination goes far beyond that. Anybody else before we...
Betty? Also work the opposite way, too. Your abilities may not be as good as that person sitting beside you. You know, and that can lead to discontent sometimes.
Yeah. I'm going to take that and look at the flip side of it. I do want to make sure that everybody's got a copy of the book. Is there anybody that lacks the material? Okay. Is it possible... Not that we're looking at this from the standpoint of pride, but to take Betty's point and flip it around. Is it possible, going back to what Doug said too, as far as the different gifts that we have, is it possible, is it right to look at our life and say, based on what God has said, based on my life, I'm certainly not perfect, but I'm really trying to do the best that I can at the present time?
Is it right to say that?
Yeah. Could we make that assessment?
Sure.
Yes. And again, we're with that assessment, we're recognizing that we still fall short. But at the same time, we're not so self-critical, as Judy talked about, that we feel like, you know, we're just worthless and, you know, life isn't worth living. So there are two sides to that, and we want to remember both sides. Okay, let's pick up what we find in the next paragraph. This is paragraph 3, those who see their faults. And we just talked about that to an extensive degree. Those who see their faults but refuse to make amends for them or correct the things that are wrong. They need to be reminded of them by those who are concerned about their welfare. Now, that's going to be something that we can do in some circumstances, but it's going to be somewhat difficult in other circumstances. If you've got someone who has been a Christian for 6 months, they came out of a very rough background as far as the world is concerned, do you think it's going to be obvious to see some of their faults? Yeah. You know, you're at services and they stub their toe. What might you hear coming out of the mouth? You might hear some pretty rough language. And we've had that here. We've had Christians out with either newer Christians or non-Christians in a public place, and some of the things that were said by that non-Christian or by the newer Christian, it made some ears burn. So we've been exposed to that kind of thing here. And that's not difficult to find and try to have a conversation with somebody and say, well, you know, have you, you know, thought about what the Bible says? Are you familiar with the Scriptures say? But what about the person that's been a Christian for, let's say, 40 or 50 years, really tried to do well? A lot more difficult for that person. I mean, still not impossible. So sometimes we can help one another. And, you know, those are good things to look for. But we still want to be mindful of what I said concerning Matthew chapter 7. If we've got the, you know, plank in our eye, we want to be focused on that before we try to go out and help the fellow who's got the splinter in his own eye. Two, he mentions the Apostle Paul was a concerned person, as we see from his correspondence with the Corinthians. His letter actually dealt with a number of faults, and here are some of them. We'll start with 1 Corinthians 1, 10 to 12.
Now I beseech you, brethren, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that ye all speak the same thing, and that there be no divisions among you, but that ye be perfectly joined together in the same mind and in the same judgment. For it hath been declared unto me of you, my brethren, by them which are of the house of Chloe, by them which are the, that they are contentions among you. Now this I say, that every one of you saith, I am Paul, and I am Apollos, and I am Cephas, and I am Christ.
Anybody ever been a part of a congregation that was obviously divided? Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4. I'm going to put my hand up for that as well. That is not a good situation. If you want to talk about a fault, if you want to talk about a mess, look at a divided church. It is not a fun place to be. And that division can be manifested in a lot of different ways. You might have some people sit on this side of the room, some people sit on this side of the room. When it's time to come in, some come in this door, some come in that door. If they're two different doors, the same is true with the exit. It is a very unpleasant environment to be in. So when we think about the faults, not only can our faults be individual, but our faults can be congregational, can't they? Isn't that exactly what we see in Revelation chapter 2 and Revelation chapter 3? John wrote to the seven, how many churches? gave you the answer, so I don't think we're getting it wrong. How many? Seven churches of where?
Asia.
And there were some good things that he had to say about those congregations, but there were also some congregational faults. And some of the faults were so bad that the Lord said, you repent or I'm going to remove your candlestick. I'm going to pull the plug on you as far as being a faithful congregation. So when we think about faults, there can be factions individually, there can be divisions individually, but it can also happen congregationally. And congregationally, we see something else in 1 Corinthians 5:1. Let's read that now.
It is actually reported that there is sexual immorality among you, and such sexual immorality as is not even named among the Gentiles, that one has his father's wife.
Okay, so we have here, as was mentioned earlier by Doug and Ray, sometimes we have sexual sins that come up, and that can be true in a person's individual life. But now, as we look at 1 Corinthians 5, that can also be where? Congregationally. Anybody ever been in a congregation where there was some kind of sexual impropriety? Okay. Again, several of us have, and that has been a problem. Some people have left the faith because of that, and it's just been a very, very bad situation. So that's a fault. And that's something that can be overcome and has in many cases, and we're grateful for that. But it's not the only congregational problem that can happen. Look at 1 Corinthians 6, verse 1.
There are any of you having a matter against his neighbor, go along before the unrighteous and not before the saints.
Okay. What was the problem in 1 Corinthians 6? All right. Have you ever been in a congregation where somebody sued another person? Huh. Well, okay. Well, I guess that's a good thing, but I'm kind of surprised. You were?
I was in a congregation that I was going to go to court on a business deal against another brother.
Okay. Well, then.
He ended up talking to the elders, and we took care of it through the elders instead.
Okay. Well, hopefully that was worked out in an equitable way for everybody involved.
Well,
but
quit coming to service.
Well, okay. I guess not so much.
It was equitable. It was what the decision the elders made was right. And this wasn't the first time he did that to somebody, so. Pretty sad is what it was.
It is sad. And I've not seen a lawsuit, but I can remember Teresa and I were newer Christians. And there was a family in Texas, nice family. I think both families that were involved in this were really nice. And the older family had a car that had well over 100,000 miles on it. And, you know, when you get cars, at least some of the older cars, as long as it was driven in the same way, it seemed like everything was going great. But once you sell that older car off to somebody and they start driving it in a different way, maybe they start hot rodding it and doing some other stuff, you know, a month or two later, bang, it's shot. And that was what we had here. There was a family that had this car that they'd taken good care of. They had sold it to another family in the congregation. The other family bought it because they needed a car that didn't cost a lot of money, and this family was willing to, you know, give them that car or sell them that car at a reduced rate. And after the car was purchased, a couple minutes went by and kaput, the car was shot. Well, now the family's got a piece of junk for all practical purposes, and you know their money's wrapped up in the car. It's only good for scrap value. They need another vehicle. And there were some very, very bad feelings. It turned somewhat ugly. So to my knowledge, there was never any lawsuit, but there was that business transaction that for the family that purchased the car, it was a bad deal. Teresa and I think we'd kind of together, we'd not been married that long, but we'd kind of, I think, come to the conclusion before that time that as far as business dealings with members of the church, we just try to avoid those. Not because we think that they're wrong, but because they can be filled with problems like that. Sometimes you may end up in a court situation. And, you know, over the years, you know, knock on wood, we've not violated our policy yet, and we don't plan to. But, you know, selling somebody like a car or even a house, and I think a house is probably a little different, but still. It can create some bad feelings if things do not go well. Now, if you've done that or if you want to do that, that's perfectly fine. You know, I'm not saying that that's something we're going to object to or it's wrong. But you have this kind of thing and it causes that strife, it causes that division, it creates that fault, and it is a big, big mess. Anybody want to?
In that kind of case, do you think that we should have been prosecuted?
Let's get to that in a second. I'm going to share with you another piece of information. When and this is one of the reasons I think why Goshen, it's not that we've had any improprieties over the years. No, I understand. We're not talking about Goshen. I don't have anything to do with the money here. Well, they pass a collection plate and I toss in a contribution, but I mean, aside from that, that's where it ends. I don't take the bag down. I don't count the money. We're headed to that. But there was a congregation within 100 miles of here that decided that the preacher was going to be the treasurer. Now, this fella was sometimes borrowing money out of that contribution. I think he was perfectly honest. But it put him in a situation where he borrowed that at various times because he was running tight in his salary and then put that back. Again, I don't think that there was any impropriety there, but I don't know that that was probably the best choice to make him the treasurer, and especially if somebody knew that and then realized that he, you know, borrowed some money out at various times and put it back. That may not be the best procedure, but when you put the preacher in that position, then it really becomes difficult. So when you have charges like that or situations like that that can lead, that's probably a situation to kind of rethink and say, okay, is there maybe a different course that we can pursue? Now, taking the matter to the level that you described, we actually have some type of financial impropriety. Let's turn it around and look at it in different terms. Let's say that you have an elder, or let's say that you have a preacher who is involved in some kind of criminal activity. Let's exclude the finances. It could be sexual activity. If it doesn't fall into the category of theft, maybe he steals a church lawnmower. Or maybe he's buying things and, using them for his own person. When we're dealing with criminal activity, does forgiveness negate consequences?
No.
Okay. For example, if you have, let's use a different matter. Let's use murder, for example. Let's say that the preacher gets mad and murders somebody. Well, would we say, well, he's a Christian? We can't prosecute him. We wouldn't want to give the evidence that we have. We wouldn't, if we were in that assembly where the preacher took out a gun and shot somebody, we wouldn't want to testify against him. What would our obligation be? All right. We remember what Paul said. Romans 13, we want to make sure that we, unless there's Acts 5:29, unless there is a problem in observing man's law, if that's going to somehow interfere with divine law, then we've got a different set of circumstances. But we are to observe the laws of man. So if a preacher or an elder, whomever it might be, a Bible class teacher, somebody sitting in the pews and just decides, hey, I didn't like the way he looked at me, so bang, I shot him, we would have an obligation to let the laws of the land function as they would we not? All right, now if that's true for murder, what about for financial mismanagement or, sexual impropriety? If you've got a situation where, let's just use rape as an analogy. All of those things would fall into the criminal category. And if we would argue this way, as far as prosecuting on these items, then when we substitute financial impropriety, even though we would recognize it's not quite like murder, I would give the same answer. But when you look at 1 Corinthians 6, you have there as far as, and we have limited information, but I don't think you can find there any reference to any kind of criminal activity. It's not brother against the state. It's brother against brother. And that's why I say you're kind of going back there to the car situation that I gave earlier, where you have a disagreement, or maybe it's, as Doug described, some other kind of civil matter, civil litigation. Third time's a charm on that. Okay.
Was he planning on paying it back?
He said he was.
Okay. There again.
And he did after he was caught, but whether he would have or not, they have no way of knowing.
Yeah. There in restitution. When we talk about turning from sin, we're trying also to make things right to the best of our ability. I mean, if we kill somebody, we obviously can't bring them back to life. But when we think about repentance, restoration to the greatest degree, possible, I would argue, is involved in that. So here again, it's going to be a legal situation, but if that fella has paid the money back,
yeah.
Again, at that point, would you need to proceed with any kind of legal proceedings? I would, like I say, I would label that as a judgment call, in my judgment, and if they've done that, then to take the steps that I talked about earlier, to say, okay, you know, we've got to, you know, restructure things here so you're never tempted again, and so we don't have this problem.
Which is what they did, but it's
yeah. But if he's paying it back after the prosecution restitution, right? If he's paying it back after that time, then that's a problem. You know, I don't know what his financial situation was, but maybe he could have sold a car, picked up a second loan against the house or the car, whatever he had, or taken the money out of retirement, and that, in my mind, would have gone a long way to saying you're trying to really make things right.
He did. I don't know how he paid it back. They said he didn't pay it back.
Yeah. But the idea that we're just brothers, so we're going to... I mean, if you take that situation, and he'd done that to somebody in the congregation, embezzled money from them.
To me, the difference is it wasn't you and I going to court with each other. It was him taking the Lord's money, the whole congregation.
Yeah.
So it's a little different than if you and I have a squabble about property or something that we... feel that you took some of my property or whatever, and I'm going to take you to court. We're talking of the congregational money and its embezzlement, and like you said, there's laws about it. But I still agree with you. I think the congregation could have took care of it.
Well,
but Old Testament says three times, doesn't it?
But some people felt that they should have gone the other way.
Yeah. There again, you're going to have to look at all the situation, all the circumstances of the situation, and make a judgment. But when you put some other things in there, as far as items like murder, you in Romans 13, you definitely do have the authority to proceed with a criminal prosecution. But depending on how things went, the attitude, that would also factor in, as far as I can tell. Just hold on, Ray. There was Tracer or somebody else had flashed a hand over here. I don't know who it was. You made your point. Okay. Ray?
We see a lot of that that went on in the Catholic Church, even the Amish groups of the child molestation and things. Church
and their group, and it didn't work out. Yeah. Well, there again, you know, civil penalties are there for a reason.
Right.
And, you know, there are some things that you can handle internally. There are some other things where you try to handle that internally. For example, you have some issues as far as Indiana, to my knowledge, is a mandatory reporting state. When you're dealing with certain, you know, Schultz Lewis, I think, you know, you had some familiar with that when you were up there. And if you don't report some of the things that the law says you're obligated to report, then that creates a whole new kettle of fish for you. So, you know, we're not legal scholars, but they're, and hopefully, and that's why I say you want to try to make sure that you have in your own life, looked at your life and tried to, you know, deal with those things, whether they're big issues or not, so we don't get into this stuff. But it does happen sometimes, and it has some long-lasting effects on congregations, as, you know, some of us have seen. Anybody else? Okay, let's see where we left off. 1 Corinthians 11, verses 20 through 34. I think we can just kind of highlight that as far as one of the faults. What was the fault there?
Misusing of the Lord's Supper.
All right, you have the Lord's Supper. It's kind of an out-of-control event turned into something like a big party. They're not observing the Lord's Supper. Paul comes down in some with some very strong language and says, you know, you can eat and drink damnation unto yourself, or judgment. It's not damnation in the sense that God's going to send you to hell because you failed to observe the Lord's Supper properly one Sunday. But very, very serious. So when we think about worship, there can also be faults. There can be bad things that happen at worship. You have people sometimes, they're just kind of zoned out every time that they're here, and that's not consistent with worshiping in spirit and truth. He mentions, too, from the book of Genesis, Genesis 40, verse 14, Genesis 41, verse 1, and then at the top of the next page, James 5, verse 16. Let's get two helpers lined up here. If you read from Genesis 40, we'll also ask you to read from Genesis 41. We'll start with Genesis 40, verse 14. That'll be Sherman. And then after we finish up with Genesis, we'll move over to the New Testament, James 5, verse 16. Who wants to take responsibility for that one? Brian, James 5, verse 16. All right, let's go back to Genesis chapter 40, verse 14. Sherman.
But remember me when it is well with you, and please show kindness to me. Make mention of me to Pharaoh, and get me out of this house.
Okay. The text for this is, you may remember that when Joseph was in prison in Egypt, he interpreted the dreams of the butler and the baker. The butler was to be freed. The baker was going to be hung. What request did Joseph make of the butler after telling him the good news? You know, you're going to be released. You're going to be restored. And after that happened, Genesis 40, verse 14, Joseph said, I want you to show what to me? Kindness. Well, if you remember that funny Hebrew word, chesed. That's the one that we talked about a couple weeks back. Remember? That doesn't seem to go quite as far as agape love, but that is that word which means kindness. It's the word which... Okay. I'm going to ask you to pronounce that after class, all right? So this is this word that means do a favor for me. Well, that makes sense, doesn't it? Joseph says, I've given you good news. So you're going to be restored. And after you get back into the king's favor, what do I want you to do for me? Yeah, put in a good word for me. Mention me to Pharaoh because, you know, I want to get out of this place as well. When we think about faults, do we sometimes forget to do things for people? Maybe things that we promise? Yeah. And maybe you have some people that, I mean, they almost never seem to forget anything. If they make a promise, they'll remember it for the next 15 years. And then you have some other people that make a promise, and how long do they remember it? It's just in one ear and just out the other. I mean, it just, and it's not that they're a bad person, but maybe they've just got a lot on their mind, or maybe they're not feeling well, or maybe they're distracted when they make the promise. So you have that kind of thing in Genesis 40, verse 14. Well, if that happens to us, we've made a promise to someone, and if we've made a promise to someone, the person that has received the promise, or the person that's asked for the promise, how important generally do you think that promise is to them? Usually it's kind of significant, because if they're asking you to promise something, if they're asking you to make a commitment, then they really think that that's important. From a Christian standpoint, what is one of the things that people often, I think, promise but fail to follow through with? Person says, I'm going through a rough time. I'm having a hardship. Would you what for me? Would you pray for me? Well, if you're asking for those prayers, what are you thinking? They're going to follow through. But do you think that there are some times where the person who made that promise just forgets?
Yeah, it's funny you mention that, because on Facebook you see a lot of stuff like that going on. They'll ask for prayers. Not everybody says praying for you, but how many really do?
Yeah.
I mean, those are words. It's comforting to hear. But you need to follow through.
Yeah, you might say, pray for me today. And not just today, but in the days that follow. So you might just go ahead and tack on a little something extra. I mean, Lois had asked about prayers for Denny. And, you know, when people come up and ask for those things, I mean, we put that stuff in the bulletin. We send out email alerts. So just kind of my two cents. If you see that coming through as an email alert, or when you take that bulletin home, try to, before you throw away the bulletin, try to, before you hit the delete button on the email, leave it in the inbox. And, you know, maybe leave it in there for a few days to remember this is something that I want to follow through, because it is very, very easy to forget things. You know, Max has asked for prayers at various times, and, you know, Ann has for Keith, and I mean, we've just got several people here that have done those kinds of things. So try to make a commitment to that. And if we forget, say, okay, God, I'm sorry. I made that promise to pray for him or her or them. I have failed to follow through. I remember my faults this day. Genesis 40, verse 14. I'm done.
Well, yeah. I prayed at least
once. We knew what you wanted. It just sounded a little unusual. So, all right. So we've got that. Let's pick up then. A few minutes left with Genesis 41, verse 41. Sherman.
41:1?
Yeah.
Then it came to pass at the end of 2 full years that Pharaoh had a dream, and behold, he stood by the river.
Okay. Filling in her blank, it seems that the butler had a short memory. Indeed he did. For already how many years had passed?
2 full years.
Well, if we get that forgetful with a prayer, somebody might be dead. The person that we were asked to pray for might be gone. Or we might be dead. So this is, you know, we can kind of smile about it, we can, you know, laugh and joke about it a little bit, but this is serious stuff. That when we think about our faults, This is one of the areas where, going back to kind of the secret sins that we talked about from Psalm 19, verse 12, I'm not sure that I would really conclude that this is a sin, but it definitely is a shortcoming for a lot of people. So when we talk about praying for people, or if somebody asks us to pray specifically for someone or something, really try to do that. And you might also, this is just, you know, another couple cents here, you might ask a person how long to pray, how long you want them to pray for something. Now, you know, in the case of sickness, a person might say, well, until it gets better. Well, okay. Or praying for a job until I get employment. But sometimes it's helpful to me to know if there's an ending date, rather than just kind of leave that open-ended, we'll just, you know, keep praying for him. Well, if it's a person in a hospital, that's kind of obvious. You know, continue to pray until they are released or that matter's resolved in some other way. Sherman?
I think one of our problems is we get too busy and we actually forget, not on purpose, but we forget. So like Teresa's method or your email, not closing your emails, those are good reminders. Because we do get busy and we forget sometimes what we need to do.
Yeah. And it may be, you know, you review your emails before you go to lunch, and maybe with a lunch prayer, if you pray before you eat lunch, before you leave work, again, you know, maybe you're praying for a safe journey on the way home, and also just kind of touching those people, because, you know, not every prayer needs to be a 5 or 10 minute prayer, and that's good.
I found it helpful, too, with, like, a drive that I do on a regular basis, like to work, to have prayer markers. When I pass it, when I get to this stop sign, that's the time I want to remember to pray. Just because that regularity of that helps me.
Or train to
Goshen. Yeah, train to Goshen, that'd be plenty of time.
Well, but we do use cues for various things. Sometimes the cues are not things that we necessarily came up with on our own, but there's something that jogs the memory, and we may try to remember names in that kind of way where we associate it with something. So that's another good thing, to look at certain points and see if we can connect a couple people with those items or maybe an event throughout the day. So that's another really good tip. Thank you.
The question I have is, Paul told us, pray without ceasing. So when does sin involve not praying? You know, when he's talking about their praying without ceasing, I mean, that means we should be praying all the time. Well, not that we don't have jobs and stuff, but I'm just saying that we should never forget to pray.
Right. The idea there is not that, you know, we're praying in our sleep. I mean, because we obviously cease some activities when we lay down at night. But there is the regularity of that. And how are we going to accomplish that? That's one thing I think that a lot of people have not thought about. But the prayer markers would be one thing. I mean, the emails come out sporadically, so if you're relying on that, that's not going to be very good. but there's that. Some people might keep a list with them. There are different things. Some people might assign time. For example, there are some people. I remember a lady from Fort Wayne, she said that prayer was how she began her day. Didn't matter what time she got up. Didn't matter what was going to occur. You know, if it was the most important day of the year, you know, she liked April Fool's out of all. I mean, that's her favorite day. But, you know, even before April Fool's Day started, I mean, she said, I'm going to pray. So that was the way that she did. One of the things that a lot of people do is pray before bed. Nothing wrong with that. But, you know, there's some people that can do that and do it well because they don't hit the pillow and they don't go right to sleep. They're just up. They just kind of thrash around for a while and, you know, maybe pray for a good while. And there's some other people, and I'd fall into this category. Teresa will attest to this. I hit the pillow and within 60 seconds, I'm out. So if I'm going to pray before I go to sleep, I mean, you need to be towards the top of the list and you need to be mentioned fast because it's not going to get done. So, but you know, you look at that as far as your personal set of circumstances and you can find out what works best for you to fulfill what Paul talked about in 1 Thessalonians 5. Praying without ceasing. You look like you're raising your hand. See, I remember.
You remember the verse. I didn't remember the verse. Thanks.
Okay.
It's interesting that you say that. We'll pray on things that are affecting us now.
Yeah.
And it is a lot harder to pray for, like you said, without the bulletin in front of you or something like that. You always remember, in our case, my case, it's always before I eat because I think of people that can't that.
All right, there again.
So that's what gets me going
right
before I eat.
That would be one of your markers. You might think especially about the people in the hospital that are not getting the food that they want, and you've got that mental jog that you use. So that's going to vary from person to person, but it is something that we do need to pursue.